Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
Because I think we're all searching.
There are some people that think that the media would bias.
It's Wednesday, September 7th, 2011, and this is the 15th anniversary episode of KBIA's Views of the News. I'm your host, Mike McKean, director of the Futures Lab at the Reynolds Journalism Institute, here with longtime colleagues Lee Wilkins and Charles Davis for another chat about the performance of the news media. Though we don't have an exact count, this is at least the 750th airing of this show since Rod Gillette launched it in 1996. As for today's topics, WikiLeaks' stash of stolen State Department cables is now out on the internet unredacted. That means the names of informants, whistleblowers, and other undercover contacts are also out in the open for the first time. Gee, who didn't see that coming? And now WikiLeaks' former partners in the mainstream media are trying desperately to distance themselves. The media remembrances kick into high gear this week as we prepare for the 10th anniversary of the 9/11 terrorist attacks on Sunday, and I'll have a few thoughts on exaggerations about the status of American journalism that appeared this week online. We're going to start, though, with the WikiLeaks story, which really broke just as we were ending taping last week of Views of the News. And the story basically is all of those State Department embassy cables that WikiLeaks had have now been released on the internet by WikiLeaks and others with none of the names of contacts redacted or marked out. And, of course, this has led to a lot of concern that now we have a lot of people out there in unfriendly governments, unfriendly countries who could be in danger. Their lives could be in danger. Their families and fortunes could be in danger. And the blame is being distributed by different parties, among others. Most people don't want to take credit for it themselves. But before we get into who's to blame, Lee, let's just talk a little bit about the potential impacts of these leaks. The first time WikiLeaks released the Afghan war logs without redacting the names, there were all kind of claims by the American government that blood was on the hands of WikiLeaks. So far as we know it, that didn't happen. But now we've got a far greater trove of documents with very sensitive contacts in them out there in the open. Might we have blood on the hands of WikiLeaks this time?
I don't know if we'll have blood on the hands of WikiLeaks this time, but I certainly think this is a phrase that we sling around a lot in another context. But I'm going to say I think it's a little bit of a chilling effect. I think that at least some of the impact of this is going to be not merely on the people who are mentioned in the cables, but on the folks who are writing those cables 3 months, 6 months, a year from now, what they're willing to put in writing, what they're not, what various governments will require them to put in writing, what they won't. Because I think this is, I would like to say that this is one-off, but I honestly don't believe it is. I think this is maybe the first time that we're going to see this. It's certainly not the last.
So Charles, address both of these questions, the one I raised, which is whether or not WikiLeaks might have blood on its hands, and the one that Lee raised about whether or not whistleblowers will be less likely to come forward now that these unredacted names are out there.
Yeah, I mean, it may be less a blow to forces in the field as it is to WikiLeaks itself as a so-called institution. I mean, if you are in the business of protecting people who wish to leak to you important documents, it would seem to me that job one would be protecting said documents from wholesale release unredacted on the internet, to which you respond, wasn't us. That's not exactly a very compelling excuse. The other thing I think it does that we'll see, but I think what it will do, at least short term, is scare away any media partnerships. Because one of the things WikiLeaks had really benefited from this time around were these high-profile partnerships. Yeah. Der Spiegel, The Guardian, The New York Times, those guys are gone now. There's no question in my mind.
I'll come back to that point in just a minute. But let's go first over all of the different sort of blame shifting or excuse making that's been going on since the release of these documents. You hear from WikiLeaks that they had no choice because The Guardian's investigative reporter had printed a password, an encryption key in a book that he wrote, that once the documents got out there in this sort of BitTorrent universe where anybody could get to them, it was only a matter of time before somebody was going to decrypt it and release the documents, so why not do it yourselves? In fact, WikiLeaks even tried to play it as, we had to do this because we're the honest broker. We're the brand that people trust. Lee?
I've got this horrible stunned look on my face. I hate for ethics to rear its ugly head, but this is one real distinction between Julian Assange and his organization and journalists. Journalists actually are capable of discretion. It is, as Charles said, if people are whistleblowing to you and part of what you have to do in order to get that story out is to protect certain kinds of information, whether it's names or information that could lead to names or, you know, whatever it happens to be, that's what you do as a journalist. That's part of your job. This was never Julian Assange's intent, based on everything I've been able to read and to understand. So, I mean, in that sense, we're not to blame. Of course you are. Absolutely, of course you are. You can't shift that one. They have an ethical responsibility, and the fact that they, quote, didn't technically release the documents doesn't in any way forgive them for not stepping up to the plate on that.
But, I mean, Assange and his defenders, to play devil's advocate for a second, Charles, say, one, we're not the ones that put the password out into the public domain. A reporter did. And there's some dispute as to whether or not they should have changed the password or encryption key. But then Assange and his defenders go on to say, we did contact the State Department, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and said, look out, this stuff's coming, protect your sources. Isn't that good enough?
When an entire tranche of unbelievably highly classified State Department cables come down to whether or not some guy who apparently Assange vaguely knew had an encryption password and key, I mean, it's like the secret handshake at the frat house. How many people had access to these highly encrypted documents? Again, it chips away at the credibility of an emerging institution that purported to say, we will absolutely protect your right to leak us documents, and we will protect said documents. And at least one half of that is now effectively gone. I mean, I just don't think they can turn, at least to the journalistic community, to the people who do have discretion and apply it. I don't think they can turn to those people and say, partner with us because we'll be responsible brokers anymore.
There are some privacy and encryption experts who are saying that, you know, you should never release this kind of information. Yeah. It's just good practice not to. And I kind of wonder why the journalist thought he had to include that level of detail in his book. Nonetheless, there were a lot of other things going on, not the least of which was the implosion within the inner circle of WikiLeaks, including Daniel Berg, their second in command, their spokesman from Germany, who broke away because he claimed that Assange was showing megalomaniacal tendencies. And so I wonder if that wasn't also part of the story, Lee.
I think it's part of the story, but I think there was a scholarly study that a lot of us cite when we're doing certain sorts of stuff, which says that a crisis reveals what goes on in institutions when things are not working well. And so normally we say what happens, you know, in the State Department or Homeland Security, whenever, when things are working fine, we have this sort of front stage of what it's like. I think what this does is it indicates all the places where WikiLeaks and the folks who run WikiLeaks didn't think it through. That password, as I understand, had been out there in print, in hard copy, by the thousands for 7 months. So, you know, saying that, oh, it's because this guy printed this password when they had 7 months to change it and to change it multiple times, no, that doesn't make any common or any other sorts of sense. But I think, again, it's part of this brave new frontier where we assume that technology is going to think for us. And one of the things I've learned about my computer is it is literally as dumb as I am. It does ones and zeros great. And after that, it needs more input.
Well, let's turn our attention for a moment to the media reaction to this story, and especially, first of all, from the media partners who have worked with WikiLeaks to release, in the past, redacted, carefully edited copies of these documents. The Guardian, The New York Times, El País, Der Spiegel, Le Monde all issued a common statement this past week, basically condemning the release of the documents and putting all of the blame on Assange. Your reaction to that, Charles, but also your reaction to this sort of my cynical statement at the beginning, who could have thunk it that this would ever happen if these major mainstream organizations got in bed with an organization run by an individual like Julian Assange?
Yeah, well, the media organization's joint statement tried very hard, and I wonder if it succeeded at all, but it tried very hard to say, we were right with him up to a certain point at which we now are no longer with him because these unredacted documents have been posted. We never agreed to that. Okay. I mean, I can buy that sort of on face value. But again, what's the larger damage done? What's the damage done to the credibility of news organizations that have to turn around, which I think, Mike, you're right, should have seen this coming, have to turn around now and say, oops, okay, yeah, the documents which we were promised and promised and promised were not going to be released in unredacted form, lo and behold, have been. And so now there are real people being hurt, really hurt. And I don't know if we can get as dramatic as blood on the hands, but let's just talk about people in the cables like human rights activists that are working in sensitive nations on, oh, I don't know, trying to install democratic forms of governance in non-democratic countries. All of those people are now outed, right? I don't know if any of them are going to disappear, but will life become fundamentally different for them tomorrow? Yes. And that's the lack of discretion by Mr. Assange that sort of colors everything he does.
But can you balance that danger, that lack of discretion, with the defenders of WikiLeaks who say they really have helped by bringing out more of a talk about transparency? And some of the stories, clearly, that have emerged from the media looking at these WikiLeaks documents have shown us, in ways we wouldn't have otherwise known, how the American government has acted or reacted to events around the world.
I don't know if you can, quote, balance it, Mike, in a way that would make all sides of the debate happy. But I can say that for practice news organizations, and all of these are that, they work with whistleblowers all the time. Yes, this is an organization, but it is fundamentally portraying itself and I think acting in a way that is about whistleblowing. And experienced journalists know that working with whistleblowers is fraught with all sorts of opportunities, some of them not terrific. You can have people recant. You can have people release stuff to multiple news organizations. You can have people steal stuff and then you get blamed for it. I mean, all of these things are well within our journalistic experience. So I'm back to Charles's. Who would have thunk it? They should have thunk it and thunk it through pretty darn carefully.
One interesting reaction I've seen in the media was from Glenn Greenwald, who's a columnist over at Salon.com, and he has been a defender of WikiLeaks for a long time, talks about how important this notion of transparency is, and he even came out this week in trying to say, well, yeah, I know they shouldn't have released the documents. It's really too bad, so sad, lots of people to blame. But how come the media aren't focusing on some of the stories that have emerged from these new documents? He points, for example, to a story that alleges to show a war crime by U.S. forces in Iraq back in 2006, or another story about Israel attacking Hamas and hitting a mosque and killing 16 people who were inside during worship. Is that a legitimate defense that we ought to be focusing on the stories that are in these documents as much as the fault on Assange for them leaking out?
No. I mean, it's a legitimate argument by itself to say, wow, there's some really good stuff in these cables that have not been explored yet at all is a story in and of itself. But to equate that as somehow absolving the wrong that has been done here is insulting, frankly, to the many, many, we're talking hundreds of people whose fundamental work life has been altered in ways that we can only begin to understand by the release of these unredacted documents. And I know I'm harping on that, but I mean, WikiLeaks likes to portray itself as a human rights organization. That's what they say every time. We are about human rights. Well, they just violated the fundamental human rights of hundreds, if not thousands, of people by disclosing sensitive information that put them in harm's way. And there's no acknowledgement of error. There's not even apology. There's finger pointing.
I guess the thing that strikes me about Greenwald's defense, at least, and I find it lacking, one, he says, well, it wasn't intentional, as if that matters. And second, he basically says that, you know, the ends justify the means. These kinds of stories are out there because of the leak of documents. But look at another bit of coverage of this story from The Guardian, which was an initial partner with WikiLeaks. And there was an interesting piece that ran in the past couple of days from a former member of WikiLeaks writing in The Guardian. Meridian. Mm-hmm. Basically, he says, I supported their principles, but I can't support their methods. And then he goes on to describe how maybe it was intentional after all, how back in November, Assange and a group of leaders of WikiLeaks were meeting in London, and according to this person who was inside the meeting, he says that all along, Assange supported the view that eventually these documents, unredacted, were going to have to get out there, and that that really wasn't such a terrible thing. So was it unintentional or was it not?
I have no clue whether or not it was unintentional. And the fact of the matter is, it doesn't matter. This is a place where, so my ethics students who are listening, guys, this is badly applied utilitarianism. And this notion that the ends justify the means, I think Charles just did a wonderful job of demonstrating why that's positively not the best way to analyze this. I don't know what Julian Assange said. I have no idea what he thought. But what I do know is that there was significant harm that appears to have been done. And whatever his motive was, it does not justify that harm.
I thought that insider piece also was disturbing because it showed how Assange and the group basically allowed this anti-Semitic's collaborator, basically, who eventually showed up with some internal documents and we think met with security forces in Belarus, and subsequently a lot of activists were arrested. Did one thing lead to another? We don't know. But according to this inside source, Assange didn't care whether it was.
Yeah, if you haven't seen it, we've got a link on the blog to this piece by the Guardian Insider, and it is so disturbing. Another disturbing part of it, Assange trying to milk the WikiLeaks defense fund for his own personal defense in the alleged rape case. I mean, there's so much going on there that we're only beginning to see what a circus. There's this paragraph buried in the story in which he says, as I understood it, WikiLeaks has no operating rules and procedures, no board of directors, no protocol for doing anything. Deeply disturbing story.
Well, let's talk about a story that was obviously deeply disturbing 10 years ago. It's impossible, really, to read a paper, a magazine, watch TV, go online this week without constant reminders that this Sunday marks the 10th anniversary of 9/11. Though news executives and cable programmers, advertisers, they're all saying that they're seeking a balance between commemoration and exploitation, clearly, we're already in for an avalanche of 9/11 media. For example, the National Geographic Channel kicked off its programming 2 weeks ago by airing an exclusive interview with former President Bush reflecting on the day of the attacks.
One of my concerns, like the concerns of other husbands and our wives, was my spouse okay? Was Laura okay? And my second concern was, were our girls okay? Took a while to find her. She was in a secure location, and it was awesome to hear her comforting voice. And she had talked to the girls, and they were secure, so that was a relief for me.
National Geographic Channel is also airing a week's worth of documentaries on 9/11. The Discovery and Science channels are running a multi-part documentary produced by Steven Spielberg on the rebuilding efforts at Ground Zero. CNN, Fox News, MSNBC, all the networks, the major papers, the magazines have special sections or programs. Even Animal Planet is showing survivors of the attack whose, quote, unique bonds with their pets help them deal with loss and cope through the pain. Well, Lee, from what you've seen so far and read so far of this coverage, are the media finding that balance between commemoration and exploitation?
I think we're probably slipping all over wherever you think the balance in that fulcrum actually happens to be. I certainly think that from what I've seen of it, and I haven't seen all of it, the National Geographic interview with George Bush, while filled with softball questions, I think was also insightful. And it makes a lot of sense that the first thing that he would think about was, is my family okay? That's the first thing everybody thinks about. You know, to expect him to respond differently as president is just plain silly. The Animal Planet one, of people who survived with their animals, okay, as we're all pet lovers, we can probably go there a little bit, but maybe not worth quite the airtime and certainly the promos that that they're giving it. Mike, you had a great link on the blog, which is one of the things that a story that I did read all the way through, which was Associated Press went out and researched about 300 and some charities that had collected a boatload of money after 9/11 to find out what they did with, what they did with my donation, because I was one of the people who who donated to one of those things. That's the kind of story that I think we should be doing, and I don't believe that that's anything other than good journalism does and an anniversary when we're all kind of paying attention.
Yeah, I like that AP story, obviously, or I wouldn't have posted it on the blog. But Charles, it seems like there are at least some attempts to do something more than just sort of the emotion-stirring, commemorative kinds of pieces. There is a little bit of real journalism going on out there. Maybe there could be a little bit more of it. What's your take on the balance question?
Oh, I think we'll see the ridiculous and the sublime. I think you'll – I mean, it sort of in many ways is a reflective lens onto journalism itself. You're going to see some really good work, and you're going to see things that make you just gasp. And probably everything in between. But I will say, if there are anniversaries that merit sort of nostalgic reflection, this is one of them. I mean, I had been in Columbia all of a year at that point, and I now look back and realize that it was one of the seminal moments that made me a resident of this community now and forever. That the bonds that were made during that time in and around this community, I think, are things that everyone shared. Yeah. And they were unique. You know, where you were did matter and continues to matter. And so there's room for some homily here, in other words.
When we think about how the 9/11 attacks affect us as individuals, I thought it was interesting to see a story that the Pew Center on the People and the Press put out a week or so ago, a poll about attitudes mm-hmm. around 9/11. And, you know, what it showed, one thing, as Charles mentioned, almost everybody knows where they were, remembers exactly what happened on that day. The highest for any event you can think of, the Challenger explosion, the Kennedy assassination, you name it, 9/11 is still very fresh in people's memories. But they also, if you dig down into that story, there was also a few other things I found were quite interesting. The public is less inclined to think, for example, that the government is doing a good job in counteracting terrorism, although the percentages are still pretty high. There's a pretty big division still yet on whether or not torture is an effective method of getting information to fight against terrorism. So we're really ambivalent right now as a people about the impact and the repercussions of 9/11.
I think one of the things that shows is that some of these questions, although we associate them with 9/11, are in fact sort of eternal. What I go back to, especially about the torture question, is for anybody who hasn't seen Saving Private Ryan, which is a wonderful essay among many other things on military ethics and why they are as they are. We've been worried about torture at least since the ancient Greeks. So the notion that, oh, geez, we just discovered it, we're just now discussing it for the first time, I think probably this is a human conversation that we're going to continue to have for, oh, at least another two or three millennia. We're probably not going to settle this one anytime soon. On the other hand, I think that there are some kinds of things that I wish we had a way of digging more deeply. And I'm seeing NPR and then Frontline really trying to sort of put, if you will, a dollar figure or a human cost figure, if you will, on some of the changes that have happened since 9/11 in this country, which continues to say, well, we're a democracy and we stand for all of these things. And then to sort of take this chance to step back and say, are we satisfied with overall arc of what has happened in the past 10 years?
And while we're reflecting on that, I just want to say a little bit more about that ambivalence, Charles, because another finding of this survey was that most Americans do not believe that 9/11 prompted a conflict of civilizations between Islam and the West, but most Americans still do say that they're concerned about the rise of Islamic fundamentalism and extremism. So we really don't know how to get a grip on that yet.
And I don't know if they asked the question about who flew the planes into the World Trade mm-hmm. Center again, but last report, I think that was last year, there was still a majority of Americans who believed that Iraqis were flying those airplanes. So our information base is a little flawed when it comes particularly to Islamism, I think.
I think the other thing is that this, like all polls, it's a creature of what you ask. So you ask about Islamic fundamentalism, you get a response. Yeah. You ask about religious fundamentalism, which is not only Islamic, I bet you'd get a slightly different response enough to for there to be some important things to talk about.
Let me get a couple of quick takes on some ethical issues around how the media are treating 9/11. First of all, the decision to show or not to show the actual video of the planes and the attacks 10 years on. Should there be some hesitance to do that, as some news organizations are showing at this point?
I think there should be a good, thorough discussion. And at the end of that discussion, I think this is a newsworthy event, and I think you show it. I don't think you recycle it.
How about the notion of advertising? Early on, after the attacks, most news organizations did their anniversary stories. No advertising within the special sections or on the air. But now advertisers are actually moving back. They want to sponsor these documentaries. They think it's not so bad to be associated with the 10th anniversary, Charles.
Yeah, I've always wondered what makes it okay to do that now and not okay to do it then. There apparently is some metric applied to it, but it's an informal one. It doesn't strike me as offensive, maybe because it is retrospective as opposed to breaking news.
I wonder, too, there's at least one meme that's floating out there now around the coverage, is that somehow the 10th anniversary of 9/11 should provide an opportunity for Americans to recapture that spirit of unity that existed right after the attacks. Is that asking for too much?
I think that's asking for too much, but it's a really decent question. I mean, considering the last 6 months that we've had politically, wouldn't it be nice if we could move off of this?
What you're thinking about that, Charles? Is it too much to expect that 9/11, the 10th anniversary, could lead to some coming together again? Is that the media's role to even try to foster that?
No, I don't think it's the media's role to try and foster that. And no, I don't think there's any likelihood of it happening at the moment. However, I would like to think that we could disagree with each other more civilly. I don't think we're going to agree. But I would like to see the ways in which we disagree become a little bit more humane, and maybe the news media can play a role in that.
Well, we want to end the show this week after those fairly heavy topics with a reflection or two about some exaggerations that have been in the news this week. First, I want you to consider a brand new survey from the same people we were talking about a few moments ago. This is the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press. And according to the pollsters there, nearly 6 in 10 American adults claim, when they were surveyed, that they plan to watch President Obama's job speech tomorrow night before a joint session of Congress. Now, think about that. Wishing it were so, but if ever there was an example of how people lie about or exaggerate or misjudge their future behavior, this is it. According to the Census Bureau, there are about 226 million Americans who are over the age of 18. So if the Pew survey's results are accurate, about 130 million of us will be tuned in to the president's speech. Well, that's 20 million more than watched this year's Super Bowl, and highly unlikely. Here's another bit of exaggeration, this one courtesy of Catherine Quigley. She's a journalism professor at Rowan University in New Jersey. She's made an animated movie that's out on the internet now and making the rounds on media-related websites because of her tongue-in-cheek take, we think, on a clueless student who wants to intern at a magazine.
You are a journalism major and don't even have any clips.
But I have that poem I wrote about death. I will send that to the editor.
No.
You are stifling my creativity. I am very creative. I want to write articles about my opinions with no facts to back them up. I want to tell people exactly what I think without having to talk to anyone or do any research.
That is not journalism.
Fine. Whatever.
Certainly not the norm here at the Missouri School of Journalism, we hope, though I'm sure we can point to a few students who fit that stereotype. Let's just hope that this will look like a parody still 15 years from now, when most likely someone else will be doing views of the news. Speaking of our birthday, let's thank Rod Gillette for launching the program in 1996. Let's thank Lee Wilkins and Charles Davis for their long-running and always thoughtful commentary, and thank our technical team, Travis McMillan with RJI, and Pat Akers with KBIA for keeping us on air and online. As always, we welcome your comments at views@kbia.org, and we encourage you to read story links and watch show clips on our blog, kbiaviews.blogspot.com. I'm Mike McKean. Please join us again next Wednesday for another edition of KBIA's Views of the News.